The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're off and running on another week of broadcasting. If you'd like to email the program or get in touch with us for any reason, send those emails to td@kpcg.fm. Well, over the weekend, we passed the 15-year anniversary of the attack on September the 11th, 2001, and it was interesting here in the UK even to just examine some of the programming on the TV guide online for free view. They had quite a few programs revolving around 9/11 documentaries. One on the that I saw a bit of Saturday night called The Fireman's Story, and it followed, well, of course, the firemen that went in there going in the direction that was the most dangerous, climbing up those towers to try to get people out, and of course many of them dying in the process. And they showed, of course, some of the scenes of bodies flying through the air, those that opted to jump from 100 stories or so above rather than burn to death. And of course we know what eventually happened to both of those towers, the Twin Towers, and also they're at the Pentagon, and the other plane that crashed in that Pennsylvania field last night, although I didn't get the chance to view it. They had another program Sunday night on 102 Minutes That Changed America. That's the 2008 documentary that first ran on the History Channel. It, again, played on one of the Freeview stations here in the UK. And so lots of looking back on that day that changed America, as that documentary is titled. And, of course, the many acts of courage and heroism. We'll talk some today about that. But also about how it just brought so many in the United States and even from around the world together. We'll talk in the second segment about that alliance between the United States and Britain, and also Little Judah, the little nation of Israel in the Middle East. After 9/11, I mean, that was a strong bind between those three nations. You talk about a strong alliance, that special relationship that President Bush had with Tony Blair here in the UK, even though they were very different politically. But it really did reveal the strength of that relationship. And also with Little Israel, as I say. But I thought I'd start with one particular act of courage and heroism that has always stood out to me as, well, it was the one that that I've gotten the greatest inspiration from, that that plane that went down in the Pennsylvania field. You probably know some of the stories surrounding that, with people in the back of the plane calling their loved ones on the plane phones or on cell phones, saying that their plane had been hijacked, and the hijackers were up front in the cockpit saying that there was a bomb on board and that they were going to head back to the airport and land and make sure that their demands were met. And of course, all of those people at the back of the plane that were on the phone with their loved ones were telling them that they're not going to land that plane at an airport. They're going to use it as a missile, because that's what's happened three times on this day, with the Twin Towers and with the attack on the Pentagon. And so there was one individual, Todd Beamer was his name. He was in the back coordinating an attack of his own. They were going to storm the cockpit and try to wrest control of the cockpit away from the radical Islamists. And we don't know all of the circumstances of what happened in there, but we do know, based on some of those phone conversations, that they did certainly storm the cockpit, and we know that that plane, of course, crashed in that Pennsylvania field. In any event, this this interview that I'll play for you, this is the woman that Todd Beamer called. She's just a phone operator. He decided he didn't want to try to call his wife because he knew that she would, that she would just freak out over what was happening. And so he opted to call this operator to figure out what was happening. And then what you'll hear here in this interview is the operator, this woman that he talked to, and this is her account of that that conversation.
When I took the call over, there was a soft-spoken, calm gentleman on the other end. He told me that there's three people that have taken over the flight. At that point, I asked him his name. He told me Todd Beamer. He was from Cranberry, New Jersey.
Did you make a conscious decision not to tell Todd about the World Trade Center? Why?
Yes. Because I wanted him to have hope. I wanted him to think that he still had a chance. I didn't want him to feel like it was just totally hopeless and he definitely didn't have a choice and he knew he was going to die. I didn't want him to have that feeling.
When he wanted to pray, was your sense then that he knew that...
Yes, I did. I felt that he knew at that time because he had said, "Oh, Jesus, help us." And then he said, "Lisa, would you recite the Lord's Prayer with me?" And I knew that he knew at that time that it wasn't much left for him to do.
What do you think that this country needs to know about the men and women who were on board Flight 93?
They're all heroes in my eyes. They really are. They all pitched together, and they did what they thought was the best thing to do at that time. And I feel that Todd played a great role in that, because when he told the guys, "Are you ready?" I assumed that they were waiting on his cue. Then they responded to him, and he said, "Okay, let's roll."
And would you please help me welcome his wife, Lisa Beamer, here tonight?
She called me that Saturday morning. I told her, I said, "You have two boys, David and Andrew?" She said, "Yes, yes, I do." I said, "You're expecting your third child?" She said, "Yes, he told you all of that." I said, "Yes, he did. And he wanted me to let you know that he loved you and his family very much." And I gave her a message and kept my promise.
So that's the phone operator that spoke with Todd Beamer before that, shortly before that plane went down. And as she said there, he evidently was the one coordinating the counterattack, saying, "Let's roll." I saw a story just the other day. He was 32 at the time, and he had two little boys. His wife was pregnant. His little three-year-old is now... Well, I don't know if he was three or four. I forget how old he is today. But his oldest son, David, attends, I think it's Wheaton College in Illinois, the same college that his parents, both of his parents, went to. And he now is the quarterback, the starting quarterback for that college team. And that college, that football team, has adopted "Let's Roll" as its motto. And it just struck me, even in seeing that clip, it's a video clip that I just played for you there, but the telephone operator, she's an African-American. Todd was, of course, white. And then this little bit that CBS put together on David quarterbacking the school and the fact that they've taken on "Let's Roll" as their motto. They had all these, I didn't bring that clip with me to play, but they had all these players and the coach talking, and they just came from all different backgrounds. You could see it in the video. And it's amazing, isn't it? You don't really look back at 2001 and think, well, the country was just so racially divided like never before. In fact, you look back on that time and you see politicians from both sides coming together singing "God Bless America" on the steps of the Capitol. And certainly firemen, black, white, brown, everything in between, rushing to try to rescue people, to try to help people. America today is, well, it's very different. We're becoming more and more divided. But going back to this motto, let's roll, I was just saying in class this morning how that's the fighting spirit that we need spiritually. I mean, given the fight that we're in every day, I mean, these people in the back of that plane were left with two choices: to sit there and die, and to see the plane that they were flying in used as a missile by these crazed, demon-possessed lunatics that were in the cockpit, or to try to wrest control of that plane away from these terrorists, even if it meant dying. I mean, both options were going to end in death, most likely. And so a group of them went and fought. They fought, and that took a lot of courage. Let's roll. Let's do it. Let's do it. We're going through Galatians 5 and chapter 6 today about the war between the flesh and the spirit. The spirit fights against the flesh. I mean, it unless we capitulate, unless we give in and just return to captivity, spiritually speaking. But a true Christian is under some kind of pressure every single day to fight, to get up and say, let's go. We've got to roll with this. We've got to stay in shape spiritually. We've got to gain strength spiritually, because it is truly a knockdown, drag-out fight. And you can look around and find some examples in the carnal, fleshly sense of those that stand up courageously, boldly, and fight against the enemy. Paul said, fight the good fight of faith. It's a good fight that we're engaged in. Fighting against evil. Fighting against our adversary, the devil. It's a good fight that we're in. And so fight on. Paul did. He got to the end of his life. Even as he was about to die physically, he knew he was going to die. He knew he was going to die. He knew he was going to be beheaded. And yet he said, I fought a good fight. I'm going down swinging. I've finished my course. I've kept the faith. That's the thing. Christianity is a battle for us. It's a battle. And we've got to fight each day, the good fight, and give everything that we can, everything possible, to keep the faith, to remain faithful to the truth, to be dedicated and loyal to the cause. So many people, spiritually speaking, have given up in that struggle. And of course, when you look at it nationally, so many people in the United States, too, have given up in the struggle. And today, as a couple of articles noted, I'll read from them here in a second. Today, we just pretend that the enemy's not there. We pretend that the war is over. And we tell the politicians, lecture journalists, as we played for you last week or the week before, to just not cover these things so much. These stories where the enemies are lashing out and trying to kill babies and women. Doesn't matter. We just pretend that, well, it's not really there, and the world's getting better and better and better. It's not. It's getting more and more evil. I noticed it was with one of the hijackings in the mid-80s. It was during in a book I was reading about Reagan, and the author was describing this hijacking, and I forget where the plane had landed. But it landed somewhere in the Middle East to let some of the women and children go free, and they kept many of the men for a time longer until the thing was resolved. I forget how. I don't remember all the details. But what stood out to me was the fact that these terrorists let women and children go. That was in the mid-80s. 30 years on from that, look at the world that we live in today. The women and the children, I mean, you run them over with the truck just like you do the men. You blow them up just like you do the men. And that comes right out of the mind of the devil. That's the kind of evil, that's the kind of enemy that the United States is facing. That little Israel is facing, Britain. Of course, the people of Europe as well. And so you know, and I know, it's building to the clash, Daniel 11 and verse 40. But looking at the United States today, in the next segment I'll play for you some clips from that time, from September of 2001. And just, again, looking at the unity politically, the unity racially, it's very different today. But just focusing in on this fighting against the enemy, this let's roll motto. Well, look at America's approach today. 15 years after 9/11, blindness to the Islamist threat is the official policy. This is by Andrew McCarthy, writing at National Review. He wrote a book a few years back. I read a portion of it called, I think it was Willful Blindness. And he says in this piece for National Review that it's worse today. It's worse today. He says, when I wrote my memoir of the jihad, willful blindness was an ingrained conscious avoidance of the abundant evidence of the threat posed by Islamic supremacism. The ideological commitment to coerce acceptance of Sharia law by force, if necessary. He says it was a head-in-the-sand approach to easily accessible proof that the threat is rooted in Muslim scripture and a mainstream interpretation of Islam that sketches back over a millennium. And McCarthy says we're way beyond that. Now it's compelled blindness. It's not willful, it's compelled. It's a tireless campaign to erase the abundant evidence, to make it inaccessible. He says, alas, apologists of the Sino-Islam school cannot seem to make the jihadist carnage go away, but they work feverishly to make sure you can't see what causes it. And so they're busy trying to erase root causes, pretending that root causes don't exist. He says, or if you do get a glimpse, because the carnage and the animating ideology are inextricably linked, and because jihadists are actually quite anxious to tell us why they do what they do, the apologists warn that you'll keep your mouth shut if you know what's good for you. The apologists are out there in force. And they're warning. You keep your mouth shut. You don't talk about it. You don't report it. You be careful. Otherwise, we may have to prosecute you. We may have to come after you. He gives an example here from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. A comment she made a few years ago about applying pressure on those who would sound the alarm and shaming them back into their place. And as McCarthy says here, she wasn't kidding. Mentions of Islam in connection with terrorism erased. Erased. In favor of workplace violence, man-caused disasters, and overseas contingencies. Investigations of prominent Islamist organizations proved in a terrorism financing prosecution to affiliate with the Muslim Brotherhood and its Palestinian jihadist branch, Hamas, that's erased. It's erased. written materials on Islamic supremacism and classical Sharia principles prepared for the training of military intelligence and law enforcement agents, erased. Instructors expert in jihadist ideology formerly retained to lecture national security personnel, erased. Terrorist detainees at Guantanamo Bay, erased, at least from Gitmo. They're heading back onto the battlefield, so many of them. But they're erased out of Gitmo. Islam is erased out of government publications. Aren't they afraid they'll go back into jihad, speaking of the Gitmo prisoners? Well, why worry about jihad, McCarthy says. According to former White House counterterrorism czar John Brennan, jihad is a holy struggle, a legitimate tenet of Islam that means to purify oneself or one's community. It has nothing to do with violence, and thus violence has nothing to do with Islam. Nothing more to see. That comes from the White House counterterrorism czar, who explained a few years back that jihad, has nothing to do with violence. Al-Qaeda's been erased, he goes on to say. First, the president and his minions tried to miniaturize it. There's no real global terror network united by an overarching ideology rooted in the Quran, the words, deeds, and traditions of the Prophet Muhammad, and Sharia fundamentalism. Instead, there are independent franchises, outposts, and wannabes, to say nothing of the JV team, that are actually motivated by parochial, political, and territorial concerns, not ideology, and certainly not any ideology tied to Islam. Well, he gives some other examples in here, making the point over and over again that you might erase the record, but you can't erase reality. He says 15 years after 9/11, Al-Qaeda has revived its breakaway faction. The Islamic State is our current obsession, and there are some understandable reasons for that, since the Islamic State controls major swaths of territory in the Middle East and projects terror into the West. But Al-Qaeda is resurgent, and as much a threat to America as it was in the late 1990s. It says, after 9/11, the American people seemed resolved to defeat jihadist terror. You'll hear that in the clips we play in the next segment. After 9/11, there was one voice coming from America. One voice coming from the Capitol. One voice coming from the White House. And it seemed that voice was resolved to defeat jihadist terror, to defeat the axis of evil. It says today the United States government is a major financial benefactor of Iran, the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism, a regime that regards our country as its mortal enemy. It says Iran has a long-standing practice of abetting Al-Qaeda. The Obama administration now has a practice of supplying Iran with plane loads of untraceable cash. That story that I just referred to last week, I think it might have been Friday, from the Washington Free Beacon, that Iran may have received as much as $33.6 billion in cash, gold payments, and other ways, with the release of a lot of those frozen assets once the sanctions were lifted. Of course, we know about the $400 million plane load of cash, or that was delivered on a plane for those hostages earlier this year, and the $1.3 billion in addition to that. And this Free Beacon piece says that all totaled, it's probably more like $33 billion. That's the administration now. Today, 15 years on, It's in the established practice of supplying Iran, the number one state sponsor of terrorism, with all kinds of money, with all kinds of cash. McCarthy says here, a threat can be repelled only by seeing it for what it is, understanding what it wants to accomplish, and exhibiting the will to deny it, however long that takes. Erasure is not a strategy. 15 years ago, we seemed to know that. That's what makes that incident inside of Flight 93 so powerful, because it was crystal clear in the minds of those passengers in the back. This is who the enemy is. This is what they intend to do. They might say one thing over the, you know, over the loudspeakers. Everybody's going to be fine. We're going to land the plane. But what is the reality of the situation? They're using those planes as missiles to attack government buildings. Most likely in the case of that one anyway, the White House, the Capitol, who knows? The World Trade Center had already been demolished. The Pentagon had been hit. And so the only option was to roll with this plan of facing the enemy, confronting the enemy. 15 years, we seem to at least have a better idea of who that enemy was. Well, in fact, as united as America was at that time, the trumpet was there telling you that for all of the force that was being shown, the United States wasn't going after the head of the snake. And we identified the head of the snake as being Iran. And now look at where we are today, 15 years later. You have an administration that, to paraphrase another title of a piece recently, an administration that sees no evil and that sees no enemies. The world's more tranquil than ever. It gets a little messy, but the evil is overblown. It's overreported. And the enemies are not there. Cuba's a friend now. Iran is a friend now. They made a pretty big, not fuss, but put a spotlight on that first, what was it, I forget the name of the airline, that went into Cuba from America for the first time in so many years. And it was this article, See No Evil, See No Enemies. It's by Elliot Abrams. But this first JetBlue flight, I think it was, that went in there, and of course, everyone was applauding that. We're friends with Cuba right now, and as it happens, the city that it landed in is the city where Guillermo Farinas resides, and he's in, I think, the 48th day, or at the time of the writing of this piece, he was in the 48th day of his hunger strike, protesting the human rights violations in Cuba, violations that have gotten much worse since the United States resumed relations with Cuba. All the red lines were erased. We've gone over on this program before. Look, we'll establish diplomatic relations. If you do this, if you change this, if you give your people more freedom. And then in the end, well, all those red lines were erased because, well, we're resuming relationships with the government, the Castro regime. And never mind the suffering people. Never mind the problems on the ground that are worsening. The human rights violations that are worsening. Look at the attacks on American interests from Iran, even in the midst of the negotiations, even since the deal was finalized in January. All of the harassment that Navy ships are now facing in the Gulf and elsewhere. these little Iranian naval vessels. The New York Times reporting on August 25th that, well, you know, we're not really sure if this is a sign of confrontation, or if these were deliberate efforts to send a hostile message. We're not quite sure. Elliot Abrams says, of course it's a deliberate effort. Of course it is. Of course it's a hostile message. They hate the United States. They want to destroy the United States. They want to destroy Israel. 15 years ago, we seemed to know that. And yet, look at America's response. As far as those incidents with the Iranian Navy, Elliot Abrams says here, what has the White House decided? To do nothing. And to tell the Navy to bob and weave and duck. The administration remains committed to its nuclear deal, above all, and is willing to allow these dangerous and humiliating maneuvers against the Navy without reply. It's engaged in covering up Iran's violations of the nuclear deal, denying them, and allowing secret exemptions. Meanwhile, Iran increases its presence and activity in Iraq and Syria and uses the nuclear deal to build its economy. Look at where we are 15 years on from that strike, from 9/11. The Washington Post wrote today or yesterday, 15 years after 9/11, the jihadist threat looms larger than ever across the globe. This is the Washington Post. This is the liberal newspaper of record there in the nation's capital. It says the struggle to defeat the global network of violent, rabidly anti-Western jihadist groups has recorded fewer successes. Indeed, the problem appears to have grown bigger. It's getting worse. It's spreading. It's metastasized, it says. It says here today there are probably 100,000 people in the various terrorist groups around the world. Well, that's quoting from a terrorism expert during the Bush administration, I think it is. But even that's underestimating it. To just focus in on the 100,000 or so that are in those terrorist groups, here again, what about the number one state sponsor? What about the axis of evil? And what about where we are 15 years on from 9/11, George Friedman's group, Geopolitical Futures, he had a piece today, or I guess this is September 8th, so a few days ago, pointing out how the world today is just like it was before World War II. What do you think Geopolitical Futures is warning of here? And with respect to the Middle East, I mean, Friedman, as he often does, he gives the big picture, talking about Russia and China and Europe and the Middle East. And with respect to the Middle East, he said during World War II, there was a rise in Islamic consciousness as well as an anti-British and therefore pro-German sentiment. In the Middle East, the situation is actually similar to what it was during World War II. And then here's how Friedman concludes the piece, if he wrote it specifically himself, maybe it was a team there at his group. In any event, the conclusion says, the widespread instability in Europe, China, Russia, and the Middle East, all part of Eurasia, is something we haven't seen since before World War II. The instability takes different forms and has not reached a critical stage. Still, economic and social crises are common, and fighting is taking place to some extent in the Middle East and on Russia's borders, and military activities are going on in China's coastal waters. These conflicts have not flowed into a single conflagration, but have begun to interact. You know, there's connections now. They're not just regional incidents. They're connected. You have refugees from the Middle East, from the Syrian war. They're spilling into Europe. And he says here, most interesting is that the United States is returning to its pre-World War II posture. Finally, he writes, the single most dangerous factor is that there are no apparent arresters. There are no clear forces that can stop the fighting in the Middle East, that can stop the EU internal crisis, or the Russian economic and strategic crisis, or the Chinese political, social, and economic crises. Without arresters, the crises will continue and intensify. There doesn't seem to be a force to contain it. That's what's most notable about this coming explosion in Eurasia, as he says. Well, I'm taking it a little bit farther than he does, but what's most notable is the United States returning to its pre-World War II posture. The piece concludes here, therefore, the only reasonable conclusion is that we are seeing a mounting crisis in Eurasia. Should it continue, it will mean a reconfiguration of this region as it was reconfigured by World War II. You read the piece, and it's a fairly long one, and you conclude that, well, he thinks another world war is inevitable. And he's right! He's right! That's the thing! We certainly haven't heeded God's warnings. But even the lesson of history here is clear. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us this week, td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG, 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma. Developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does He allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
My fellow citizens, for the last 9 days, the entire world has seen for itself the state of our union, and it is strong. Tonight we are a country awakened to danger and called to defend freedom. Our grief has turned to anger, and anger to resolution, whether we bring our enemies to justice or bring justice to our enemies, justice will be done. I thank the Congress for its leadership at such an important time. All of America was touched on the evening of the tragedy to see Republicans and Democrats join together on the steps of this Capitol singing God Bless America. And you did more than sing. You acted by delivering $40 billion to rebuild our communities and meet the needs of our military. Speaker Hassert, Minority Leader Gephardt, Majority Leader Daschle, and Senator Lott, I thank you for your friendship, for your leadership, and for your service to our country.
That was, of course, President Bush from September 20th, 2001, that speech that he gave there in Congress. That was 9 days after 9/11, and he talked about the unity that that tragedy had brought to those in government. He assured the American people that justice would be served and that the state of the United States, the state of the Union, it was strong. It was strong. And then a standing ovation with applause that went on for, as you just heard there, 34 seconds. Both sides of the aisle for 34 seconds. Standing and clapping. Well, that tragedy from September 11th, 2001, it happened just 4 months or so after my father had announced that we prophetically had entered into the last hour. That was May 5th, 2001. And then about four months later, who can forget, those who were old enough to see it as it played out on television, when those 19 religious zealots, radical Islamists, hijacked those commercial jets and then brought down the World Trade Center, the Twin Towers, and blasted a gaping hole into the Pentagon, and the other one, as I mentioned in the last segment, that crashed before it hit its target. You should go back and just read and study the Last Hour book, that book that came from that message given back on May 5th, 2001. My father points out how that God allowed 9/11 to signal to us and to the rest of the world that we are very near to the prophesied return of Jesus Christ. He said things are never going to return to the way it was before 2001. America's not going to get stronger. In fact, Iran, the state sponsor of terrorism, is going to grow stronger. That's what we were saying. Even as the president was, you heard the part of the speech I just played it for you. It was one of his finer moments as a president. It was strong. It was bold. It was courageous sounding. And of course, following after that, there was a real show of force, first in Afghanistan, then in Iraq. There was a strong desire to eliminate the threat of terrorism. And yet, as we wrote, I believe this was in the November 2001 issue, which was put together within weeks of 9/11. We said that despite this retaliation that was coming, that America's enemies would actually emerge from the so-called war against terrorism. Stronger than before. Stronger than ever. The president did have enough courage to identify Iran as part of the axis of evil. And would you say Iran today, 15 years on, would you say that Iran is weaker since 9/11 or stronger? Well, you would say that Iran is much stronger, much more stronger than ever before. And would you say America is stronger since 9/11 or weaker? Look at all of that strength, that show of strength. There's a verse in Leviticus 26 that says your strength will be spent in vain. Look at how much blood we spent in Iraq, in Afghanistan. Look at how much money was spent. On the day of 9/11, the U.S. national debt was $5.7 trillion. Now we're just a little ways away from $20 trillion. Almost, what, double, triple, quadruple the debt from back then? Just 15 years? Tim Thompson, writing in that same November 2001 Trumpet issue, the late Tim Thompson, he said, this magazine has been warning the world that a globe-impacting financial shock to the American economy was coming. We just didn't know exactly how or when. Yes, indeed. Look at what's happened since. And then following 9/11, the financial meltdown in 2008. It's amazing if you look at Friedman's piece at Geopolitical Futures. He comments in several instances there on that long article of just how much the 2008 meltdown is connected to a lot of this turmoil that we see in Eurasia, in Europe, in Russia, in China, in the Middle East. Another trumpet writer, the late Ron Fraser, he also wrote in that issue, the first one to be produced after 9/11, he said that the U.S. and Britain were entering into an unwinnable war. He said that it would sap our nations of strength, of energy, of morale, obviously of money. And today, of course, it's so bad that, as I read to you in the first segment, we just try to erase the fact that we have enemies. Mr. Fraser wrote this, a protracted, debilitating war that will gnaw at the vitals of declining Anglo-American influence in this world, leaving them most vulnerable to the whim of the emerging three great power blocks that will seize the opportunity to divide control of the global system among themselves. See, in Friedman's piece, he basically was talking about the three great power blocks: Europe, the kings of the East, Russia and China, and then the king of the South, the Islamist state of Iran. And there was Ron Fraser, 2001, right after 9/11, talking about the three great power blocks that would emerge during this so-called war against terrorism. He was basically saying that America's hour of trial, that Britain's hour of trial, that it would become a window of opportunity for these other great power blocks. That's happened. How could we say right at the start that this was an unwinnable war, that Iran would emerge stronger? Who was saying that even? Who else except the trumpet? You talk about another trumpet issue that's just spot on Go back to that November 2001 issue, 15 years ago. You look back at these speeches, what President Bush had to say, one of his finer moments as a president for sure. You look at the relationship between the United States and Britain. Well, Tony Blair was there present at that speech in 2001, September 20th, 2001. Notice what President Bush went on to say here about that relationship between the United States and Britain. This is clip 3.
America has no truer friend than Great Britain. Once again, we are joined together in a great cause. So honored the British Prime Minister has crossed an ocean to show his unity with America. Thank you for coming, friend.
That's President Bush talking about the special relationship between the United States and Great Britain. These two coming together, George Bush and Tony Blair, despite their political differences, what an alliance. Britain providing all of that support and that encouragement and that help in the war against terrorism. That tragedy on 9/11, it really did show how durable, how strong that alliance between the U.S. and Britain still was. Now you look at the relationship today. Would you say that the relationship between America and Britain is stronger than it was following 9/11 or weaker? Well, just a few months ago, you had the President of the United States here in Britain saying that if you don't stay in the EU, you're going to go to the back of the line. He didn't come here to say that America has no truer friend than Great Britain. He came here basically to announce that that friendship is pretty much over if you vote to leave. That's the state of the once special relationship between the United States and Britain. What about little Israel? Notice what Benjamin Netanyahu had to say following the attack on September the 11th.
It's part of this alliance inherently. It's been supporting the United States. It wasn't a day, I can say, in the 3 years that I was prime minister, that our intelligence services didn't pass on significant intelligence to you. And may I say, it was a two-way street. So we're really, it's as close an alliance as you can have, and we will help in any way that we can.
It's as close of an alliance as you can have. He was hearkening back to his first stint as prime minister there in the mid-1990s. And of course, now, today, he's prime minister again. It's as close of an alliance as you can have. Would you say that that alliance is closer than it was in 2001? No, you wouldn't. You'd say it's much, much worse. We've reached a historic low point in U.S.-Israeli relations. Who can deny that? And the thing of it is, it's all prophesied. Isaiah 9, it talks about Manasseh devouring Ephraim and Ephraim devouring Manasseh, and together they go against Judah. That's the United States, Britain, and Israel, little Israel. Zechariah 11 talks about the bands that once brought these three together being severed, breaking apart. This alliance, this historic alliance, it's breaking up, isn't it? just as God prophesied. Strength spent in vain, just as God prophesied. And it's leading to what Hosea describes in chapter 5. Sickness in Ephraim. A big gaping wound with Judah. And, well, Manasseh's invisible. Manasseh's not mentioned. Just like in the Daniel 11:40 prophecy. So weak, so sick, so unable to act with courage to get rolling against the enemy, to face and confront the enemy. That's Hosea 5 and verse 13. It gets so bad that Ephraim and Judah, they seek help from the Assyrian. And it leads to what Hosea also says in that same chapter about the pride of Israel falling in just what? 1 hour's time. Unraveling ties, brotherly division, the emergence of these world power blocks. Well, there's a lot of other prophecies that certainly relate to this, but we don't have enough time to dig into them all. The good news, of course, is that it leads to the return of Jesus Christ. We're in the last hour before Jesus Christ returns to this earth and establishes God's kingdom on earth. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.